Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and I am honored to be your host for today's teleclass, Emerging Carbapenem Resistance, What Do We Do Now? On behalf of Professor Sayan Sattar, the co-founder of the teleclass education lecture series, let me thank you again for joining us today. Our speaker is Professor Andrew Seymour of the University of Toronto and of Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. For those few who might not know of Professor Seymour's work, he is a leader in Canada, and I dare say a world leader in many aspects of infection prevention and control. His work at Sunnybrook and with the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program has brought him face-to-face with many of the most challenging microbes of our time. And as recently as June of this year, the CNIST group published a report on carbapenem-resistant gram-negative bacteria in Canada. We are seeing this topic appear in journals and at lectures and conferences all over the place these days, and I am very pleased to introduce one of the people who is on the cutting edge of that topic. Without further ado, I give you Professor Andrew Seymour. Andrew.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for your kind introduction, and I think you've correctly highlighted that carbapenem resistance is certainly emerging as a major global problem in the management of infectious diseases. I hope everyone is on the first or title slide, and I'll just highlight that the problems of antibiotic resistance, the information about epidemiology, transmission, laboratory detection, treatment, and infection prevention is much more complex, far more complicated today than it was 10 or 15 years ago because of newer mechanisms of resistance and a broader spectrum of organisms. And I think the problem of carbapenem resistance is a perfect example of this. This is a relatively recent phenomenon that has posed a huge challenge for those of us who treat patients with complicated infectious diseases and certainly for those of us in the field of hospital epidemiology and infection prevention and control, again, a very challenging problem, and I'd like to address some of those issues today. I think I must also acknowledge and perhaps apologize to the international audience in that most of the data that I will be presenting is North American data, either from the United States or from Canada, and I apologize that I'm going to be presenting far less data from Europe or other parts of the world, but we'll obviously point out some of the data that's relevant internationally. Perhaps if we could move to the second slide, just to acknowledge that I don't have any disclosures or conflicts of interest to declare with regards to this presentation. And the next or third slide just summarizes the basic objectives of what I'd like to be able to discuss with you over the next three quarters of an hour or so. First of all, to ensure that we all have an understanding of the current epidemiology, risks and impact of carbapenem-resistant organisms in hospitals, what is the burden of disease, and why is this a matter of some concern, and then to consider some effective strategies for preventing the emergence and spread, specifically of carbapenem resistance in healthcare settings. And again, most of the data will focus on acute care settings, although there is some evidence that this form of resistance is also becoming more prevalent in long-term care as well. If you move to the next slide, this just illustrates the problem of increasing antibiotic resistance, which of course we've known for many years now, but the sad irony of it is at the very same time that rates of antibiotic resistance are exploding with more mechanisms of resistance and more organisms becoming resistant to commonly used drugs, at this very time is when new drug discovery and the availability of new anti-infective agents is becoming more and more limited. There are very few new drugs in the pipeline to deal with this emerging problem of antibiotic resistance. And so although the subject of an entirely different presentation, I think it is important that those who are involved with healthcare policy consider how this important conundrum can be best addressed, because now is the time when we need new novel agents with novel mechanisms of action to treat these infections, and this is exactly the time when the pharmaceutical industry is failing to meet this need. But it also highlights the critical importance if we have fewer agents available for treatment, we should also become smarter in what we do to go about preventing the emergence and transmission of this resistance, and perhaps we'll have an opportunity to discuss that further later on. If you could move to the next slide, then, carbapenems is the big gun. Because of the emergence of many other mechanisms of resistance, especially in gram-negative bacteria, such as the spread of ESBLs, gram-negative organisms with extended spectrum beta-lactamases, we have come to rely on carbapenems as the big gun, sort of the final drug that we can go to because of the extraordinarily large and potent spectrum of activity of these agents. The carbapenems that are available, at least in the North American market, are summarized here. There are four of them currently available. They include ertapenem, imipenem, meropenem, and doripenem. And although there are some pharmacokinetic differences between some of these drugs, one important difference relates to spectrum of activity, namely that ertapenem does not have activity against Pseudomonas aeruginosa, whereas the other three agents, imipenem, meropenem, and doripenem, do include Pseudomonas as part of the spectrum of activity. And in fact, the next slide just highlights the broad spectrum of activity that carbapenems have. As a generality, carbapenems are active against most strains of streptococci, enterococci, methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus, importantly, not MRSA. They have broad activity against most Enterobacteriaceae, including those that are ESBL producers, those that produce extended spectrum beta-lactamases or have AMP-C-mediated resistance to cephalosporins. They also, in general, have a broad spectrum of activity against many non-Enterobacteriaceae, the so-called afermenters, like Pseudomonas or Acinetobacter, and many of them, or most of the carbapenems, also have broad spectrum activity against most of the common anaerobes causing human infection, including in many cases Bacteroides fragilis. And as I've mentioned, importantly, ertapenem is not active against Pseudomonas, although the other carbapenems are. The next slide then talks about how carbapenems are commonly used. And we can either break it down by syndrome or by pathogen. Because of their very broad spectrum of activity, they are often used empirically for sepsis of known etiology or NYD, not yet determined. So any patient who's acutely ill and septic, especially if it's a nosocomial infection where there may be concern about antibiotic-resistant organisms, carbapenems are commonly used as part of empiric management. Along the same reasoning and the same line, they're commonly used in intensive care units for the management of nosocomial pneumonias, especially ventilator-associated pneumonia, again, because these are liable to be caused by multi-drug-resistant organisms, and we've relied on carbapenems to be able to address that issue empirically. And the third common clinical syndrome where carbapenems are used are for intra-abdominal sepsis, again, especially that is already nosocomial, complicated surgical procedures leading to intra-abdominal sepsis. These infections are typically polymicrobial and, again, often due to resistant organisms, so carbapenems are commonly used. There are other settings where carbapenems are also used, not highlighted. For example, other polymicrobial infections, such as complicated diabetic foot ulcers with or without underlying osteomyelitis. They're often used if Pseudomonas aeruginosa is either suspected or confirmed, and so too Acinetobacter, often drug-resistant intrinsically. Carbapenems may be used if Acinetobacter is suspected or proven. And again, you can appreciate many of these utilizations are most common for hospital-acquired infections, especially in critical care settings or in the ICU. So carbapenems have become very commonly used drugs and in many cases have been the drug of last resort. But as the next slide indicates, carbapenem resistance has definitely emerged, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. This has occurred most commonly in gram-negatives, and I'm not going to be addressing resistance in gram-positives or in anaerobes today. Our focus will be on gram-negatives, and this resistance has occurred primarily in Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Acinetobacter species, and Enterobacteriaceae, especially E. coli and Klebsiella, but as we'll describe, and other coliform organisms as well. And even today, my discussion is not really going to include resistance in Acinetobacter to any great degree. I'm going to focus primarily on resistance in Pseudomonas and in the Enterobacteriaceae. The next slide just summarizes the major mechanisms of carbapenem resistance, especially in these gram-negative organisms. And there are really two major mechanisms that have been described. First are changes in outer membrane proteins, and this is part of the normal gram-negative cell wall. These outer membrane proteins normally provide a permeability barrier that may inhibit the uptake of many antibiotics, including carbapenems, but for those strains that are susceptible, antibiotics like carbapenems may gain access to the cell cytoplasm through porins, which are these outer membrane proteins. However, if there's a change in the outer membrane proteins with a porin loss, this creates a permeability barrier that impedes access of carbapenems to the site of action where they bind the targets in the cell wall that they bind to, known as penicillin-binding proteins. If this porin loss or change in outer membrane proteins is also combined with the presence of either AMP-C beta-lactamases or ESBLs, then the strains easily become resistant to the carbapenems as well. So this mechanism of resistance, changes in the outer membrane proteins with loss of porins in combination with AMP-C, beta-lactamase, or ESBLs, has been found most commonly in Pseudomonas and is the major mechanism of resistance to carbapenems in Pseudomonas species. The second major mechanism of resistance is actually related to the production of carbapenemases, and this is analogous to beta-lactamase production in other organisms, rendering resistance to penicillins or cephalosporins. Only here, beta-lactamase has specific activity that also inactivates carbapenem structures. But they're not just active against carbapenems, they're generally active against a broad spectrum of beta-lactams, so that they render the organism resistant to carbapenems, but also resistant to broad-spectrum penicillins and cephalosporinases. And as we'll describe, there are a variety of carbapenemases that have now been reported as well. And in fact, the next slide just summarizes the different kinds of carbapenemases that have been reported. They're broadly categorized as class A or serine carbapenemases. And the major example that we're going to discuss are these KPCs that you see listed there. There may also be so-called class B or metallobeta-lactamases, short form for metallobeta-lactamases, MBL. And again, a variety of enzymes have been described. The major example we're going to discuss today are the so-called NBM1 beta-lactamases in this category. And then the third group are the oxabeta-lactamases, which I'm not going to dwell on. These have been found primarily in Acinetobacter. And I'm going to come back to talk about these different carbapenemases in more detail a little bit later. But this is just to introduce you to the concept of the two major mechanisms of resistance: changes in outer membrane proteins, predominant in Pseudomonas, and the carbapenemases, which may occur in Pseudomonas, but have been seen even more often in non-Pseudomonas gram-negatives. So the next slide is just the introduction to how common is this anyway and why are we worried about this. So if we move to the next slide, this highlights a study in Canada that Paul referred to in his introduction, published in the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy just a few months ago. This summarizes the results of a one-year surveillance conducted by the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program here in Canada that in this case involved 20 Sentinel hospitals across the country that did prospective surveillance for carbapenem resistance and gram-negative bacilli in 2009 and 2010. And during this surveillance, more than 58,000 gram-negative bacilli were screened for Pseudomonas resistance, for carbapenem resistance, and included 6,200 Pseudomonas aeruginosa and then a much smaller number of Acinetobacter baumannii, but over 52,000 coliform organisms, most commonly E. coli, 34,000, and Klebsiella species, more than 7,000. So these are the organisms that were examined for carbapenem resistance in this cross-Canada surveillance. The next slide summarizes the results for Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter. Of that large number of Pseudomonas aeruginosa that were screened, 206, representing 3.3% of all the Pseudomonas aeruginosa, were carbapenem resistance. And the vast majority of this resistance was presumed to be due to outer membrane protein changes, because only 5% of the carbapenem resistant strains altogether, only 11 were associated with a carbapenemase. And there were only two carbapenemases identified. Most common 8 was this VIM, V-I-M, which refers to the Verona integron metallobeta-lactamase. And then a less common, only 3 isolates had this so-called GES carbapenemase. So again, overall, only 3% of the Pseudomonas were carbapenem resistant, and most of those did not have a carbapenemase associated with it. A little less frequently, in Acinetobacter baumannii, again, only 9 strains altogether, less than 3% were carbapenem resistant, all of them associated with that OXA carbapenemase. The next slide summarizes the results for the Enterobacteriaceae, and here carbapenem resistance in 2009-2010 was even less frequent, only 59 isolates altogether, representing 0.1% of all of the Enterobacteriaceae. And of these, as you can see, only about 1 in 5 were associated with a carbapenemase. And the most common carbapenemases identified were KPC in 7, NDM1 in 2, and SME in 1. And the coliforms that were identified in this surveillance were predominantly Klebsiella, E. coli, and Serratia. So as a snapshot, back in 2009 and 2010, carbapenemase resistance occurred, but was quite rare in Canadian hospitals. This stands in contrast to the experience in countries in other parts of the world, as I'll shortly describe. But I think I also want to emphasize, importantly, this was 2 to 3 years ago, and the situation is rapidly changing, where rates of carbapenem resistance in Canadian hospitals has increased since this point in time, although much of this is still anecdotal reports and not published data. The published data hopefully will come out in the very near future. So the next slide, I just want to move to specifically focus for a few minutes on carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas aeruginosa in particular. In the next slide, just to remind you why we want to even look at it in Pseudomonas, Pseudomonas aeruginosa is the second most common isolate found in U.S. intensive care units, and I think it's fair to say that we have similar findings in Canadian and European ICUs, and here, as pointed out, it is the third most common isolate in Canadian ICUs and also on Canadian non-ICU hospital wards. So this is a common organism in healthcare facilities and responsible for significant infections. The next slide then highlights carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas, which is mainly due to changes in the outer membrane proteins, the loss of the OPRD gene, or increased MC expression. And as I've already mentioned, is less often due to the presence of a carbapenemase. But when carbapenemases have been reported in Pseudomonas, the most common is the VIM, metallobeta-lactamase. Somewhat less frequently, it's also the IMP. Carbapenemase has also been reported, and so too has the NDM1, metallobeta-lactamase, also been reported in Pseudomonas. The next slide is just the title page of an article that was published in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology a few years ago, highlighting an outbreak of Pseudomonas aeruginosa resistant to carbapenems that occurred in Calgary, Alberta. And this particular outbreak was clonal and was associated with the VIM metallobeta-lactamase. In this case, VIM2 was the carbapenemase responsible for this outbreak. The next slide just highlights a number of studies that have looked at the epidemiology and risk factors associated with carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas aeruginosa. The major risk factors included admission to an ICU, so most carbapenem resistance have occurred in ICU patients. Secondly, perhaps not surprising, a major risk factor was prior treatment with a carbapenem. So if the patient had already received treatment with imipenem or meropenem, this predicted infection with a carbapenem-resistant strain of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. But perhaps less clear as to why this should happen, but prior treatment with other broad-spectrum antibiotics, in particular prior treatment with a fluoroquinolone, such as ciprofloxacin or levofloxacin, prior treatment with vancomycin, or prior treatment with piperacillin tazobactam, were also identified risk factors for the development of carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas aeruginosa. If you move to the next slide, I'll just share with you a study we did at our own hospital here in Toronto and presented at the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America a few years ago. We are a large tertiary care teaching hospital, a major referral hospital for Southern Ontario here in Canada, and we noticed an increase in carbapenem resistance in our Pseudomonas aeruginosa from 4% in 2002 to 15% in 2010. Almost all of the resistant Pseudomonas occurred in our ICU patients, you can see about 80%. And we did a case control study to identify risk factors for resistance in our hospital, and it's similar to the data I've just shown you, namely an ICU admission was a major risk factor with an odds ratio of about 3, so a threefold increase of risk of an ICU admission as compared to non-ICU and as compared to non-carbapenem-resistant strains of Pseudomonas. And likewise, prior exposure to a carbapenem was a major risk factor, but so too is prior exposure to a fluoroquinolone. In our hospital over these years, we did not have a clonal outbreak, as had been reported from Calgary, but rather in our hospital there were multiple clones, and only 3 of our cases had a carbapenemase. These 3 were all the IMP carbapenemase, and so most of ours were presumed to be related to the presence of changes in outer membrane proteins. And the implication there is, because it's multiclonal, we were not seeing a lot of patient-to-patient transmission, but rather most of this emergence was probably related to patterns of antibiotic utilization. We'll come back to talk about the opportunities, therefore, in terms of controlling the transmission of this kind of resistance. We were also interested to note that although carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas was associated with increased in-hospital mortality, that is, if you had a carbapenem-resistant strain of Pseudomonas, you were more likely to die than if your infection was caused by a carbapenem-susceptible strain. But despite that, interestingly enough, ineffective antibiotics were initially prescribed in about a quarter of these patients, so obviously many of them may have been prescribed a beta-lactam or a carbapenem prior to knowing about the carbapenem resistance, but this was not associated with a statistically increased risk of increased mortality. So in fact, if you turn to the next slide, titled Carbapenem Resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa Outcome, in the published literature as well, the carbapenem resistance was associated, at least in univariate analysis, with a significant increase of mortality as compared to susceptible strains, but this was not uniformly found, although carbapenem resistance has been associated with longer length of stay and increased costs. So there is an important burden of disease associated with carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas. The next slide asks the question, which is quite interesting, does ertapenem use spare the development of carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas? And so by way of background, I'll just remind you, ertapenem is unique among the carbapenems in that it doesn't have any activity against Pseudomonas. So you certainly would not be using ertapenem if you were suspecting Pseudomonas infection or if you documented Pseudomonas infection. This has led a number of investigators to theorize, well, maybe if you use ertapenem preferentially to one of the other carbapenems, when you were not worried about Pseudomonas as being the cause of your infection, by using mer ertapenem, could you perhaps reduce the risk of the emergence of carbapenem resistance? And highlighted here are three studies that have attempted to look at this, suggesting that perhaps you could reduce the risk of carbapenem resistance by using ertapenem preferentially. Certainly, there were no studies that found an increased rate of resistance in Pseudomonas, and that suggested there may be a benefit. These are obviously suggestive studies and hypothesis production studies, but are not definitive evidence of this. So I'd like to turn now, if you go to the next slide, to the problem of carbapenemases, and particularly carbapenemase production in Enterobacteriaceae. So just to remind you that carbapenemases are enzymes that hydrolyze or break down carbapenem antibiotics, and they typically also hydrolyze most other beta-lactams and beta-lactamase inhibitors. So they are cross-resistant not just to the carbapenems, but indeed to virtually all available beta-lactam antibiotics. These enzymes may be chromosomally encoded, but they are more commonly found on plasmids and therefore are plasmid-mediated forms of resistance. And obviously that contributes to more easy transmission of this form of resistance. The next slide just summarizes again and is similar to the slide that I showed previously, the major classifications of these enzymes. And starting on the right-hand side of this slide are the so-called class A or serine beta-lactamases. And they're called that because the amino acid serine is at the active site of this enzyme. They are not inhibited by EDTA, and I mention that because that may be valuable as a laboratory screening method for detecting this particular form of carbapenemase. And again, the major examples are the so-called KPC, VIM, and IMP beta-lactamases, although there are others, and I'm going to make some specific comments about KPC enzymes in a few moments. If you now turn to the left-hand side of this slide, it highlights class B metallobeta-lactamases, and they're called metallobeta-lactamases because they contain a metal, in this case a zinc atom, at the active site of the enzyme. Because they're a zinc or a metal, these beta-lactamases are inhibited by EDTA, at least in vitro, and again, that may be helpful as a screening method in the laboratory. And again, there are many examples of these metallobeta-lactamases, and I've highlighted a few of them here, NDM1, IMI, GES, SME. I'm going to focus specifically and talk about NDM1, because that is emerging as the primary metallobeta-lactamase of concern on a global basis, although, as I say, the others have also been well described. And then last but not least, the class D enzymes are the OXA48 enzymes, which have been reported, I've already highlighted, especially in Acinetobacter, but among the Enterobacteriaceae, they have also been reported in E. coli, Klebsiella, and Enterobacter, to name just a few of the Enterobacteriaceae that they've been described in. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about these enzymes today just because time does not permit. So how common are these enzymes? Well, globally they are emerging at a very rapid rate. These are data in the province of Ontario for the period from April 2008 to March 2012. And you can see that they're really just a matter of a few dozen of these, most commonly NDM1s, KPCs, and the OXA48s, especially found in Klebsiella and in E. coli. What I can say, though, is that the first half of 2012 has found almost equal numbers as all of 2010 or 2011. So the numbers are definitely expanding rapidly, and there are increasing reports globally of these kinds of carbapenemases causing resistance in Enterobacteriaceae. So I think we are on the cusp of a dramatic explosion of these forms of resistance globally. So the next slide just highlights the two forms of carbapenemase mediated resistance in Enterobacteriaceae that I want to highlight. The KPC enzymes, and KPC refers to Klebsiella pneumoniae carbapenemase. And then secondly, the NDM1, or New Delhi metallobetalactamases, that I want to highlight today. And I'm going to start by looking specifically at the KPCs. If you would advance to the next slide, the Klebsiella pneumoniae carbapenemases, and as I've mentioned, these are class A beta-lactamases, also known as the serine carbapenemases, because serine is the active component at the active site. This gene, specifying the production of the KPC enzyme, resides on a plasmid or a transposon, so it is easily transmissible. And again, similar to many of the other carbapenemases, it's not just active against carbapenem antibiotics, but indeed hydrolyzes all the beta-lactams, and therefore is typically multi-drug resistant. The next slide just summarizes some of the risk factors that have been associated with KPCs, including prior use of multiple antibiotics, not just a carbapenem, but it may be another broad-spectrum beta-lactam or a fluoroquinolone. Another risk factor is prolonged hospitalization, and in particular, intensive care unit admission. The next slide just presents some data from the United States. KPCs were first reported from the United States, from North Carolina, but since then have spread to involve many parts of the United States and indeed are endemic in many hospitals, especially in the American Northeast, but from the United States have spread to any parts of the world, especially Mediterranean Europe, and there have been large outbreaks reported in those settings as well. As shown here, meropenem-resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae increased from 0.6% in 2004 to almost 6%, so almost a tenfold increase in 4 or 5 short years in the United States. And NHSN surveillance in the United States in device-related infections found carbapenem resistance in about 11% of Klebsiella and 4% of E. coli. And again, these numbers and this incidence rate continues to rise since these publications appeared just a few short years ago. And indeed, the next slide just highlights that KPC is now the most common carbapenemase found in the U.S. And if you look at New York City, 2% of all ICU patients have been found to be colonized or infected with KPC back in 2008. And these KPCs accounted for 26% of all invasive Klebsiella pneumoniae infections. So again, in New York City, 1 in 4 Klebsiella infections in their ICU patients are associated with the production of a carbapenemase and are therefore broadly drug resistant. And this is creating huge challenges for the management of these infections, both when you know it's caused by this organism, but even empirically in these ICUs, trying to figure out what anti-infective agent can be used because these organisms are so drug resistant. And as I've highlighted, this is, if you turn to the next slide, this is not just a problem in hospitals, but not surprisingly, because hospitalized patients are also transferred commonly to long-term care facilities, there have now been at least 2 outbreaks caused by KPCs in American long-term care facilities and nursing homes. On the right, a report back in 2008 with non-clonal spread of KPC organisms in 7 New York City nursing homes involving several different enzymes and in particular several different strains of Klebsiella and E. coli in long-term care facilities. And I have no doubt that as KPCs become endemic in New York City hospitals, they are also going to become endemic in New York City long-term care facilities. And the report on the left from the MMWR last year was a clonal outbreak in a West Virginia nursing home involving 19 patients. So these enzymes are clearly going to be established in our long-term care facilities once they also become established in local acute care facilities. And obviously, once they're established both in the acute care and in the long-term care, it's sort of ping-pong back and forth, creating an even more higher level of endemicity in these settings unless we are able to intervene effectively early on. The next slide just highlights studies that have looked at outcome associated with these organisms, and similar to most other forms of antibiotic resistance, I suppose it's no surprise that KPC infections are associated with higher mortality rates than if the infections were caused by carbapenem-susceptible organisms, and many studies have documented this now. So again, highlights why we should be sounding the alert for this form of resistance. It is not benign. The next slide is a global map trying to indicate where and how frequently KPCs have been identified on a global basis. Now, this is as of 2011, and I've not seen a more updated slide, but I'm sure it's even more widespread than it was then. But it highlights, first of all, places where KPCs, even up to 2011, were already hyperendemic. And as you can see, if you look in the B part of the slide, which focuses on the continental United States, that purple area was New York State and northeastern United States, where it's clearly become well-established as an endemic area. If you look at C, it's also become established in parts of Mediterranean Europe and the Middle East, especially Greece, Turkey, the Balkans, and also in Israel. And those strains probably originated from the United States based on genomic phenotyping. Likewise, if you look at panel A, there's an endemic area in Colombia. And if you look at panel B, there's an endemic area in China as well. So it clearly has spread globally and is emerging in many global areas. Again, if you go back to Europe, although not hyper-endemic in the same way as it is in the Balkans, you can see the green-shaded countries have also had widespread experience with KPCs, so that it's become widespread throughout continental Europe as well. And if you look at the Americas map on A, it's been found in many other countries in South America, including Brazil and Argentina, and certainly also been found in Canada. I've already given you some of the Ontario data that have been reported to the Public Health Agency in Ontario. And in Ontario, there have been a few localized outbreaks, just a handful of cases without widespread transmission. However, as you go to the next slide, clonal outbreaks have been well described in New York, in Israel, Greece, Colombia, Brazil, China, and Canada, to name just a few countries that have reported their experience with outbreaks caused by KPC organisms. In terms of the Canadian experience, go to the next slide, was a study published just in the last month describing a KPC outbreak in a Montreal hospital ICU. In fact, two Montreal hospitals each experienced with outbreaks due to KPC organisms. This is just one of the hospitals and their experience in the ICU. And I just want to highlight, first of all, the total number of patients was more than a dozen. However, what I want to highlight is the fact that, first of all, it was spread over a more prolonged period of time, and secondly, it involved multiple Enterobacteriaceae species. So it wasn't just a clonal Klebsiella, but it involved not just Klebsiella, but E. coli, Citrobacter, and Serratia species. Again, just illustrating the ease with which the plasmid or the transposon can be spread not just from one strain of Klebsiella to another, but among different Enterobacteriaceae species. And that obviously provides a challenge in terms of the appropriate management of these infections. As I've mentioned, there was a similar outbreak in another Montreal hospital that in fact was even more extensive over a more prolonged period of time and involving a larger number of patients. I can say in our own hospital, in our burn unit, we imported a patient with a KPC organism. The patient had come from a hospital in New York before being admitted to our hospital and brought the KPC Klebsiella with them from the New York hospitalization. And this particular strain of Klebsiella with the KPC then spread to three other patients before we were able to control the extent of that spread. Fortunately, only one of our four patients was clinically ill. The others were just colonized with the KPC, and we've not had any KPC in our hospital for more than 2 years now. But again, just illustrates the potential that this organism has to cause serious infection. I'd like to move now to the next slide, which highlights the other prominent form of carbapenemase, which perhaps is even more worrisome, and I'll explain why in just a moment. This is the NDM1. NDM1 refers to New Delhi metallobetalactamase, and it too is plasmid-mediated, and it has also been found in very many different coliform species. Virtually every species within the coliform or Enterobacteriaceae has been reported to have NDM1, including E. coli, Klebsiella, Enterobacter, Serratia, Proteus, Providentia, Morganella, Salmonella, Shigella. These have all been reported to have NDM1s. And like KPCs, they are in fact cross-resistant to all beta-lactams. So they are predictably resistant not just to carbapenems, but also to the penicillins and cephalosporins and to the penicillinase inhibitors. And they are also typically also cross-resistant to many other classes of antibiotics, not just beta-lactams. The next slide just summarizes again the global epidemiology. The reason the strain is referred, or the reason this particular enzyme is referred to as New Delhi metallobetalactamase, is because it was first described and reported in the Indian subcontinent, especially in the city of New Delhi in India. And it is, in fact, now endemic in South Asia, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and in Sri Lanka. From there, however, it has spread globally. The initial spread was recognized in the United Kingdom and a few other European countries, and initially was primarily related to travel, and in particular, medical tourism to the Indian subcontinent, but since then has also developed the capacity, not surprisingly, for nosocomial spread within these hospitals in these other countries. But medical tourism is and remains an important risk factor. And if you turn to the next slide, just to remind you that international travel, of course, is an important risk factor for being colonized or infected with resistant organisms that may have been acquired in other parts of the world where these resistant organisms are endemic. And that certainly applies to medical tourism. And the map just shows a number of countries that very actively promote medical tourism, that advertise what they claim is a very high level and inexpensive and timely provision of medical care. And so many patients go there, including many from developed countries. So certainly in Canada and the United States, medical tourism is very common because of the perception that more timely medical care can be provided, perhaps providing procedures not covered at home for a reasonable cost. And that includes travel to the Indian subcontinent. And certainly coming back to NDM1 in particular, NDM1 producing bacteria have been very clearly associated with admission to hospitals in South Asia, as have other ESBLs and other forms of resistance. But NDM1 has been most prominent most recently. However, NDM1 is no longer just associated with medical tourism. In other words, you don't have to have been hospitalized in India or Bangladesh in order to pick up the organism. First, if you go to the next slide, again, just some of the global epidemiology as of 2011, highlighting that the epicenter, the origin for NDM1 appeared to be the Indian subcontinent, but has clearly spread. The initial spread was to many European countries, as shown there, but there's also been spread to other parts of the world, including North America, of course, both the United States and Canada. And as of this reporting, you can see that the number of cases were still relatively small, but I can reassure you that there is, a virtual explosion of the number of cases that are occurring in many of these countries, in particular, not always associated with medical tourism. So although medical tourism is an important risk factor, and that should be part of the questions that patients should be asked when they are admitted to hospital, because it does present a risk for antibiotic-resistant organisms, as I'll highlight in the next slide, you don't have to have been an inpatient. This was a study which, in fact, was highly publicized and politicized because the Indian government did not want these results widely published or disseminated. And my understanding is that the lead author, Timothy Walsh, is in fact considered persona non grata in India for this reason. And in fact, some of the study had to be done surreptitiously in India. But basically what they did is they wanted to determine whether there was an environmental reservoir for the NDM1 form of resistance. And I think many of you can imagine that sewage and water cleanliness in much of India does not meet standards that are prevalent in the developing world, certainly in North America, the United States, or Australia. And what they found was that NDM1, the form of that resistance, was widespread in organisms, including E. coli, Klebsiella, and other Enterobacteriaceae, found not only in sewage in New Delhi and other parts of India, but indeed in tap water as well. And they found it in 2 of 50 wash specimens and 12 of 170 sewage specimens. And as I've highlighted, although E. coli was predominant, it was in fact found in 20 different bacterial species. So what this implies is that obviously the organism is being shed through feces into sewage, and because of inadequate chlorination or filtration, also making its way into tap water and potable water, and thereby placing large numbers of the general community at risk, even without hospitalization, and potentially travelers to India as well, who may go as tourists or travelers who don't require hospitalization in India, but as part of their travel, ingest potable water, either by drinking tap water or by drinking vegetables or fruit vegetables or fruit that may have been rinsed in tap water. They may be ingesting organisms that have the NDM form of resistance, but then bring these organisms back to their home countries. So as I say, it is no longer just medical tourism that accounts for the spread and dissemination of NDM1, but even travel to an endemic area is also adequate. That's one mechanism of dissemination of the organism. Of even greater concern to those of us who look after patients in hospital is the fact that nosocomial transmission can and does occur. And as I've highlighted, the initial reports came of nosocomial spread in the United Kingdom and some European countries. Nosocomial transmission has now occurred in other parts of the world, including in Canada. And there have been several hospitals in Canada that have now had experience with nosocomial transmission of NDM1 strains. Again, to my knowledge, all of these outbreaks have been controlled. We had in our own hospital transmission to a total of 4 patients that again occurred over a period of several months, but that transmission appears to have been halted. We've not had any further transmission for more than a year in our hospital. So it is possible to control the spread if there are adequate infection control measures in place, but the risk continues to be there, and I'm sure we will see more and more transmission over time. So it's no longer just imported, but has the potential to become endemic. The next slide summarizes the typical antibiogram for these NDM1 organisms. And although this is NDM1, I should mention that most of the other carbapenemases, including KPCs, will have a similar antibiogram or antimicrobial susceptibility profile. And what you see on this slide is that basically there are very few of the currently available drugs available that we can rely on. And as you can see, there are really only 2 that have any appreciable activity. One is this antibiotic called tigecycline. It's a glycyclcycline product that can be given intravenously. It's quite expensive. Even then, only about 60% are susceptible in vitro. But even more important is, although they may be susceptible in vitro, they may not be very effective in vivo. And in particular, if the infection is a pneumonia or bloodstream infection, even though the organism may be tigecycline susceptible in vitro, it is not very effective clinically. And that's because the level of active drug in lung tissue and in blood is relatively low. It's not a good drug for treating pulmonary infections or bloodstream infections. So tigecycline is not a reliably effective drug for these infections. The only agent that has been found to be reliable to this point in time is colistin, also known as polymyxin B. This is not a new drug. In fact, it's a drug that was available in the late 1950s and 1960s. It's basically a detergent. That's how it works. And for this reason, although it's been around for many decades, has not been used very much because it is extremely toxic. In particular, it is nephrotoxic. A significant number of patients treated with colistin will end up with renal failure. So it is not a drug of choice, except in this situation, it may be the only drug that can be used to treat these NDM1 infections or to treat other infections caused by carbapenem-resistant organisms. And indeed, in many parts of the United States where carbapenem resistance has become endemic in their ICUs, colistin is being used frequently, and the price that we pay for having to use colistin a lot is not only higher rates of significant nephrotoxicity, but also now the emergence of colistin resistance in these organisms. And once we have colistin resistance, there are no active drugs available to treat these infections. And so we really run the risk of having untreatable infections emerging. So that's one of the reasons why these carbapenem-resistant strains are very important to keep in mind. We have very limited treatment options, and if we're stuck only with colistin, it's not going to be long before we have colistin resistance and no drug available to treat these infections. So if we move on to the next slide, I just want to make a few comments that treatment is also complicated by diagnostic challenges. Laboratory detection is problematic for a variety of reasons, and I'm not going to dwell on the details except that you should be aware of these problems. The next slide just shows the current CLSI breakpoints for determining resistance. The criteria are the same for doripenem, imipenem, and meropenem, slightly different for ertapenem. And as I've mentioned, we know predictably ertapenem does not work against Pseudomonas. The next slide then just highlights that these breakpoints that have been used improve the sensitivity of detection, but you may still miss it using automated systems like Microscan or Vitek, so that it may miss resistance in a small number of cases, and it may overcall others in terms of carbapenemases. So not all strains that look like they're resistant by higher MICs will have the carbapenemase. And as a result, a number of disc approximation tests and e-tests have been developed to screen for carbapenemase resistance, but the gold standard detection is PCR. The next slide is an example of a complex series of disc diffusion tests using the meropenem discs along with the incorporation of either boronic acid or EDTA to try to distinguish the different kinds of carbapenemases. And again, my purpose today is not to go through the laboratory detection, but just to show that these methods are somewhat complicated, they're laborious for the lab, and they are not 100% sensitive or specific. The next slide shows another commonly used test you may hear of known as the modified Hodge test. And again, it is somewhat laborious. It's reasonably good for KPCs, but it will easily miss the NDM1s, and it is also nonspecific. It will give you false positive results. So the gold standard really is PCR detecting, and I recognize that's not available in all routine labs, so my suggestion is whenever carbapenem resistance is suspected based on your standard tests in the lab, if they don't have PCR tests available, they should be referring the isolates to a reference lab for PCR testing to detect the presence of the carbapenemases. The next slide also shows the problems with screening. We're used to screening media for MRSA, for VRE, and even for ESBLs. There have been a number of chromogenic media developed for detecting carbapenemases, especially KPCs as well. These are two such media. There are others. And although this study suggested that this KPC chrome agar was 100% sensitive and 98% specific for KPC detection, which is pretty good if KPC is all you're looking for, it is less effective against the other carbapenemases. So again, potentially problematic as a screening media to look for other carbapenemase-producing organisms. So the next slide just asks, or just highlights, that carbapenem resistance can arise in one of two ways, either emergence in a previously susceptible strain, which obviously occurs under antibiotic selective pressure, or by person-to-person transmission, which may be colonal or transmission of the plasmid. And this highlights two different approaches to infection control that may be used. The next slide asks, which of those are more important? And basically what they did was surveillance in an ICU, doing serial perianal swabs on admission and weekly to look for any penem-resistant Pseudomonas, and then typing the strains. The next slide summarizes the results. In over 7,000 patients, they found 300 with any penem-resistant Pseudomonas, half of those detected on admission, half acquired in the ICU. When they looked at the pulse field gel electrophoresis profiles, about a third of these cases suggested transmission, and about a quarter had a previously any penem susceptible strain, and their follow-up isolate had the same pulse field as the susceptible strain, suggesting selective pressure. So clearly, both occur, both transmission and emergence under antibiotic selection. The next slide highlights the CDC guidance for control of these resistant strains that were published. And if we turn to the next slide, basically what the CDC suggests for all healthcare facilities: common sense things, hand hygiene, contact precautions, patient-staff cohorting, contact screening if you recognize a case, and appropriate antimicrobial stewardship. They don't at the moment recommend routine screening for these CREs unless there is evidence of CRE transmission. So if you've already had CRE transmission in the facility, then they do recommend active surveillance as well as the use of 2% chlorhexidine bathing. And the next slide just indicates that there has been success in using some of these methods. In New York City, active screening identified colonized patients who would otherwise have been missed. A bundle approach, similar to the approach to other resistant organisms, with active surveillance, contact isolation, flagging, and environmental cleaning, has been found to be effective in outbreaks in Israel and in the States. And in fact, there's been nationwide control in Israel, as shown in the next slide. This was a study published by Schwaber in Clinical Infectious Diseases, just showing on a national basis the use of a bundle approach was very successful in bringing the levels of CRE down. So I'll just conclude, if you go to the next, and I think the last slide, just highlighting the challenges that we're faced with the management of this form of resistance. There is easy plasmid transmission, especially true for NDM1, but it's also been described with the other carbapenemases. Environmental contamination may be common and often unrecognized. We do not currently have a good screening media for this, so it's very laborious in the laboratory, and there are difficult algorithms for detecting and confirming this form of resistance. Treatment options are limited, and we don't really have good evidence in terms of what effective strategies for infection control are. With that, I'll end and hopefully have time for a few questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very comprehensive. Even though you said you didn't have much time, you covered quite a lot. I had the occasion to talk to Tim Walsh last year, and I speculated then that if he'd called it something other than New Delhi, that he may still be able to travel in that country. But
I think you're right, and it's unfortunate that there's been a history of naming new forms of resistance based on where they were first isolated, and I guess that was the precedent that he was following.
The people in Norwalk know that problem very well, I think. Dr. Seymour, thank you again very much for what is, I think, something we're going to hear a lot more about. I hope you won't mind if maybe I invite you back again in a future year to give an update on this, at least on the Canadian situation, because it certainly bears watching, and bears watching very, very closely. To all of you then, thank you for joining us today, and I will look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.